So the topics for these talks of the retreat are the four foundations of mindfulness. And for me, one of the connotations of a foundation is something that lays at the base and supports everything else. And so these four foundations can be seen as kind of the cornerstone or basis or the support, the ground upon which we tend to build our lives. And our lives can get quite complicated and a lot to consider and think about and relate to. And from time to time, it's very useful to go back to basics, back to the foundations. And sometimes we go back to basics, we get a new perspective on our lives and what's important. And so to have the body, your embodied life, your embodied experience be a foundation is so invaluable. It can be easy to spend hours, days, months, a lifetime in one's head, in stories and imaginations and fantasy and projections and not be in touch with lived life as it's actually lived and experienced. And to come back to the body is one of the places to find that grounding, to find, come back to basics, and perhaps to recalibrate, to have a better understanding of what's important for us. Sometimes we can learn that we don't have to base our life on imagination or fantasy or stories. We can base it somewhere else. And then the second foundation of mindfulness is something called the feeling tone. And this is also a way to get back to the foundation, to the basics. Something so basic. At times when I've been practicing with the feeling tone of experience, it's been so basic, I've been almost on the edge of being embarrassed that everything can get reduced to these three different characteristics, which I'll describe in a minute. And then the foundation of the quality of our mind, or the quality of the heart. That the quality of your heart is such a precious thing. And are we really the custodian, the caretaker of this beautiful quality? And how do we care for it properly? How can we enhance or develop the quality of our heart, the quality of our being, really? And then the last foundation, to have be founded on truth, to see clearly this, you know, probably for this point of view, say the psychological truths upon which we operate. So you know that Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on freedom from clinging, freedom from grasping. And for this, I kind of like the analogy of a fist. If you make a fist and walk around with a fist has some usefulness. You can get people's attention if you hold your fist up in front of their face, if you really need to get their attention. Maybe it's useful, but it can be counterproductive too. Or if you're a baby, old enough, a fist is very helpful to have a temper tantrum, pound the table. So there's a variety of things that fists are useful for, but if the hand is held chronically in a fist, it's not really useful for much of anything else. And we have a hand that's meant to be opened so that it can do all kinds of things with it. So that, you know, certainly we can pick up different things. If I was to grasp onto this striker and cling to it, make a hard fist and cling to it really tight, and that's all I ever did, I'd have a hard time eating my soup. You know, it just doesn't work so well as a spoon. I have to be able to put it down and get a spoon. You can't be holding on to one thing all the time. And some of the most beautiful things that human beings can do together happen with the hands open. You know, we can stroke someone with affection. We can shake their hands. We can offer them our support if they need help, lift them up or hold them up with our hands. We need to be able to have an open hand to be able to care for each other. And our relationship to nature. And I think of an open, the palm of the hand is the part that's most sensitive. And so if it's curled up in a fist, that which is softest and most sensitive about the hand is not available to experience the world around us. Experience the breeze against the palm of our hand, perhaps, or all kinds of things. So the mind is the same way, that if we make a fist in our mind, then it might be useful in some circumstances. Maybe in some circumstances it is appropriate and helpful. But if it's chronically, we have a chronic mental fist, then the mind can't function in its full capacity, just like the hand can't function in its full capacity. And so it's hard to pick up new things. It's hard to be flexible and fluid. It's hard to know when to put down one thing and pick up something else when you're holding on to something for dear life. And it's also some of the beautiful qualities that the activities that our mind or hearts can do are maybe not available if we're chronically tense or clinging to something or resisting something, tightening down, bracing ourselves. And so it's possible to release the grip of clinging in the mind and the heart, and that's part of the process of these four foundations of mindfulness, is to help us do that, help us get back to the foundation, to the origins of things, the basis of things, so that there we can make it easier to maybe begin understanding where it all begins, where it all occurs. The difference between maybe the hands and the mind is our body only has two hands, but maybe the mind has a lot of different hands to grasp and cling. So we can cling to many things at the same time. And so some things we cling to more than others. So how do we loosen our clinging? How do we let go? And in doing so, in letting go and opening the mind, opening the heart, then we become much more available to respond appropriately in many different circumstances. If it is appropriate to grasp or cling, then we're available for that. But if you're clinging to the wrong thing, maybe you're not available for the right thing to cling to, if there is such a thing. So to be able to have the ability to put things down, to open up, to relax, even if it's just temporarily, it's a great thing. Take a vacation from clinging. Maybe when we advertise retreats at IRC, we can advertise them as vacations from clinging. Would people come? The second foundation, second area for establishing mindfulness, is called Vedana. Usually translated to English as feeling. I kind of like the word feeling tone, because sometimes in English feeling is almost used synonymously as emotions. Whereas what's meant here is something very basic. I like to think of it as part of the common denominator of our experience. And sometimes, as you know, I think in mathematics sometimes, if you can find the common denominator, the whole thing's easier to solve, the problem. And so if you can find the common denominator of all our different kinds of experiences we can have so many different kinds of experiences, but if we can find the common denominator, we get a toehold into them, some leverage, some ability to look more deeply and relate to them in a new way. So the common denominator of all experiences are that they are either pleasant, unpleasant, or, in the way that's worded in the ancient tradition, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Sometimes said in English to be neutral, but the technical expression is neither pleasant or unpleasant. So these are the three options. And the theory of this is that there are no other options. There's in all the different diversity of things we can experience, in terms of the feeling tone, some people call it the hedonic tone, and that doesn't go over very well. But it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, those two. So, and why this is, so, you know, that's kind of basic to all things. And depending on which of those qualities an experience is, or an event is, something we experience, we tend to relate to it differently. So if something is pleasant, there's almost a natural tendency to want more of it, often, or an initial tendency of wanting. Or if something is unpleasant or painful, there's often a movement to pull away, or make it go away, or to stop the pain. Sometimes, if it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant, sometimes it's a relief not to be part of that whole pleasant, unpleasant world. But more often it's said, I don't know if it's true, but it's said that it lends towards confusion. You don't know whether to go towards something or away from something if it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. It can operate on very simple things, and probably if you pay attention to what motivates you here in the retreat, you might notice how some of this operates. So, for example, I've eaten food on the retreat, like today's lunch I thought was quite good. It was very pleasant for me, and I wanted seconds. And it was clear to me that I didn't need to eat seconds, but I wanted more of that pleasure. And luckily I was eating far away from the table, the serving table, so maybe I wasn't so tempted. But, it's just very simple, very almost innocent. It was pleasant, it was enjoyable to eat, and then, enjoyable to the tongue, enjoyable texture, enjoyable, associations with that kind of food for me. So a variety of things about it which was pleasant, and so, comfort food, perhaps polenta like that, and so wanting more of that pleasant, of the comfort. In years past, I have pursued such pleasure to the point of discomfort. You want more of that pleasure, more of the pleasure. And in fact, it's been very pleasant on my tongue as my belly gets sicker and sicker. It's kind of amazing, that we have this capacity to. Sometimes, some things I've been a slow learner for. The most extreme, example from my life was, for about 7 years, I had an allergy towards wheat, and I didn't know it. All I ate was a college student. All I ate was wheat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then I went and worked at a bakery, and that's all. So there's this wheat flour and dust everywhere. Just wheat, wheat, wheat was my life. So I think probably became allergic because I overdid it, but I didn't know it at first. And at this bakery, they had these wonderful baguettes, and so I would start feeling miserable because this wheat allergy would kick in because I was eating bread, right? And so I wanted comfort, I wanted pleasure to soothe myself. So baguettes are really great comfort food for me. So I would eat some to feel better, and then I'd feel worse. So I wanted to do something to make me feel better, right? So I'd eat more baguettes. And so it went. I had no idea what I was doing to myself. I was kind of spiraling downwards because I didn't know that the effect that this wheat had. And I remember walking around San Francisco in a complete daze. I guess I was thinking because I had this thought, but I was just like, I couldn't recognize that I had any thoughts at all. I was just kind of like numb. And I thought, certainly they're going to have to institutionalize me because, just like, everything was just complete fog or something. So it was a pursuit of pleasure, in a sense. That was the comfort or something. that wasn't serving me, wasn't helpful to me, and I couldn't see that connection. And many things, the theory around the feeling tone, which I think is, this is why it's embarrassing, is that a lot of things that we're attached to, that we pursue, sometimes is not based on our political philosophy, you know, or a great philosophy of life or something, but it's based on this very simple desire for pleasure or to avoid pain. It's a very simple thing. And in fact, sometimes people's political philosophies started off with this very simple movement of not liking something. It's unpleasant, wanting to make it go away, and they build a case, and they build a case, and before you know it, there's a political party or philosophy of life. And, you know, it can be very complicated. I've known people who have amazingly beautiful, creative, legalistic minds that can argue sophisticatedly whatever they want. But if you kind of probe and go deep down and find out where it all began, it just began, just they didn't want something that was unpleasant. Sometimes it's a very particular thing, like, you know, some particular sensation that was unpleasant, but sometimes it's a whole experience, complicated, big experience, that in and of itself might be complicated, but the experience itself was unpleasant, and the unpleasantness was not complicated. That was really a simple thing. So the whole thing was unpleasant, or it was pleasant. I want more of it. And so a lot of the movement for and against things can be motivated by seeing things as being pleasant or unpleasant, relating to experiencing that way. And so to begin using the quiet of a retreat, quiet of mindfulness, use mindfulness, to begin tuning in to this common denominator, tune in to this foundation of things, and see how many things arise, get built on this simple response, and I mean, this response, this simple experience of pleasant and unpleasant and neither. So if you sit and meditate, for example, and your body hurts, that's painful. And so what is the relationship you have to that pain? Or maybe you sit down and meditate and you have a sitting which is very nice and very pleasant. And what's your relationship to that? And how do you attend? And there's a very interesting exercise to do. I think it's interesting. Imagine a time in your life, some situation, where you had no wisdom available. Maybe you were stressed out and really tired and hungry, and whatever capacity for wisdom you have just was not really nearby. And in this kind of difficult, stress kind of circumstance, if something challenging happens to you, something painful happens to you, what's your gut response in being in conflict like that or challenged? And different people have different gut responses. Some people, I tend to go quiet. I kind of tend to go inside when things are challenging or difficult. That's my, you know. And so sometimes, you know, if I'm really challenged by something, someone has to help pull me out because, you know, that's where I go. Other people attack. You know, there's a problem. Blame or anger is more the thing. And they kind of, or some people run around in circles, or some people get afraid, or some people start analyzing like crazy. Some people are filled with doubt. There's all these different kind of strategies people have. And so when you sit and meditate and your knees hurts or your back hurts, does some of the common strategies you have kick in? Do you know what they are? Do you get angry? Do you make grand conclusions that it's hopeless? Or do you blame someone else? Or do you blame yourself? Or do you go into fantasy? Do you check out and say, well, forget this? Or do you attack? I had a friend who, in meditation, his knee hurts, so he would hurt it back. He would, you know. And eventually he had to have knee surgery. So that wasn't a good strategy, I don't think. And so, you know, what is, you know, so what, you know, So part of the value of this kind of situation, this laboratory of practice we have here, is to begin paying attention to see how do we react, how do we respond when things are pleasant or unpleasant. Do we make it more complicated than it needs to be? Do we have these gut reactions to it, strategies to deal with it? And to ask those questions is very powerful, because I believe that a fair amount of the time that we can take, we don't really see that our strategies are strategies. We just think that's the nature of things. We're angry at the situation, and of course we should be angry. The situation is wrong. Or, of course, you know, this is the way things are. But to begin getting quiet enough and questioning, what is my response? Do I need... And then one of the radical questions of meditation practice that can translate into daily life is the question, do I need to have any response at all? The knees hurt, and after you ascertain that, you know, it's not going to damage it, or you're impatient, or you're bored, or you're delighted, or you're getting lots of joy in meditation, or, you know, anything at all can happen. The question is, does it need any response from you at all? And perhaps more often than not, it doesn't. It just needs recognizing. Just see it. This is how it is. It's pleasant. It's unpleasant. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And just leave it. Very simple like that. It's painful. Just leave it. It doesn't need a response, perhaps. And I think that because, you know, minds are often kind of response machines, it's a radical thing to begin questioning. Do I need a response? Can I just be simple here and let it be? So, you know, there's many, many circumstances in the course of a day on retreat where you can have the opportunity to feel whether something is pleasant or unpleasant. It could be as simple as opening the door and touching the wood or touching the handle. And perhaps it's cold and it's a little bit unpleasant. Perhaps it's smooth, and that smoothness is pleasant. Some people lean into that. That's some people's primary orientation in life is feeling pleasure and wanting more pleasure. So they tune into those all the time. But for people who don't, it's very interesting to start doing it so that they start becoming sensitive to it. Does it show you, teach you about how you tend to respond, your strategies, your reactions, the world you build on top of it? So it gets more interesting, his teachings on the second foundation, feelings, vedana. The word vedana means something like a way of knowing. So a way of knowing things is by knowing this feeling tone. And so when the Buddha talked about the vedana, he talked about these three different kinds. But then he distinguished between two different big areas of human life where they play out. And this distinction between these two areas is a very interesting one, and in some way or other is one that many different cultures will make distinctions like that. Some people make the distinction between spiritual and material. Usually, you know, one is good and one is bad, but that distinction. Some people will make the distinction between worldly and non-worldly. There's that the things of the world, and there's things which are not of the world. There's a distinction between what's dualistic and what's non-dualistic. There's what's inner and what's outer. And so some different people find it very useful to make these distinctions that point to things which are distinct in certain kinds of ways. And so the Buddha did this as well. And when he talked about feeling tone, he distinguished between two categories of feeling tone, that which is of the flesh and that which is not of the flesh. And that's the literal, or that which, yeah, so the word, anyway, that's the literal meaning. Translators normally don't translate it that way into English. Some of them will translate it as spiritual and worldly, or worldly and non-worldly, or sensual or non-sensual, the different ways in which they try to do it in English. And I think the distinction is that there are some sensations that we have that occur because our normal senses are being stimulated. So if I touch something that's smooth, it's my flesh, it's the nerves in my skin for touch which pick it up and feel it. If I see something pleasant, it's the nerves, you know, and the eyes that are activated and see. And those are our senses, so that's sensual. It's of the flesh. And there's no judgment that it's, you know, bad or good either way. It's just that this is one domain of our life where things can be pleasant or unpleasant. The sensual world, in a sense. And then there's a whole other category of inner experience which can happen, which is not, does not occur because our five senses are being stimulated. And so we can call it the inner life. And so the inner life as well has pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And so it's and some people don't really have a good sense of that there's an inner life as well. Some people are primarily focused on the sensual world of things and people and events and you know, things we can look and see and touch and feel, as if that's the you know, where the solution to life is going to be found. And but there's a whole other area of life that also exists, which is this non-sensual, this inner world. If you've probably noticed, Jack Kornfield's titles of Jack Kornfield's books almost always have the word heart in them. And I suspect he's kind of pointing to this inner world. For him, the word heart is probably, you know, represents that, of the heart. So, and what happens if you begin, so what are some of these inner, non-sensual, not of the flesh experiences you can have? The primary one that the early Buddhist tradition points to is for the pleasant inner experiences is the experiences that arise in meditation. So if you sit down and meditate and you start feeling relaxed, that sense of relaxation that occurs, it maybe is part of this, or some of these things that happen with the relaxation. Maybe the relaxation itself is sensual because the muscles feel better. But if you take make a really, again, a hard fist with your hand, hold it for a while, you don't have to do it, but then do it for a while, and then the longer you do it, and then at some point you let go of that tension, you'll feel all this tingling and movement of energy in your hand with the freedom of that, the blood or nerves or something happens, and it feels quite freeing and nice sometimes to have that release. So the same thing, as we begin relaxing and letting go of the held places in the body, held places in the mind, there's a kind of release of energy that happens, a kind of loosening of things, and the energy begins flowing more freely. And that energy that starts flowing and moving can feel pleasant. And so this is beginning to point to this pleasant, inward pleasantness that can happen, that can only happen when we're not contracted, when we're not held tight. If we hold ourselves held or resisting or bracing ourselves or tense, then there's a whole category of inner pleasure, delight, or joy that can't come to the surface. And it isn't like we have to do something. It isn't like winning the lottery, you know, or getting the perfect date or something. It's not a thing that has to happen, but it's more like an absence of things. It's more like a letting go and releasing of all the tightening and constrictions that we have. And in that releasing, this energy or this pleasure, this movement of well-being or ease begins to bubble up. And that inner sense of ease, that inner sense of well-being that can happen sometimes in meditation is the primary definition of the pleasant, non-sensual feeling tones. The primary representative of the unpleasant, non-sensual, the inner feeling tones is unfulfilled desire to practice. So if you really want to practice, you know, have a spiritual life or kind of touch into this inner world or this spiritual world, whatever you want to call it, and you just can't get a chance to do it for whatever reason, then there's this kind of feeling of dissatisfaction from that. And that dissatisfaction is unpleasant. And that's considered to be an unpleasant sensation of this inner world. And I had that when I was when I was first introduced to this practice in Thailand. It became very quickly became very important to me, and it became the most important thing for me to continue doing. There was nothing else in my life anymore that made any sense really for me. And so I went back to Asia to practice again. And I was determined to go to Burma at that time because the source of this meditation practice was in Burma. But it was hard to get into Burma back then. It required a special visa. And it took me about 9 months to get the visa. And so, maybe more than that. And so then, and during that time that I was trying to get back to on retreat, I went through, you know, I don't know if it's what the original meaning of this term, but kind of dark night of the soul. Because nothing else mattered. And what was really important was to go into that world again of practicing. And I just wasn't able to do it. And so this would be, qualify as this inner or non-sensual, unpleasant sensation. And then I finally got the visa when I was in Bangkok. I left the Burmese embassy with a visa in my passport. And I went literally kind of running and skipping down the street of Bangkok, very happy and singing the lyrics, "You can do it if you really want, but you got to try, try and try." And then I went to meditate in Burma. Is it an interesting or useful distinction for you, this distinction between an outer and an inner life? Or, you know, do you focus mostly on the outer life? That the outer life, in the outer life, the world around you, the connection with friends and work and pleasures and of life, in a certain kind of way, is all mediated through your sense doors. And so it's kind of, in a certain kind of way, belongs to the outer world. Maybe it touches parts of the inner world, which are meaningful, but, you know, it's, you know, and, but a person, some people can be primarily focused on the external world without any sense of an inner life. And so it makes sense, if that's the case, then it makes sense to try to focus the best you can on fixing that external world or arranging it just right so that it can be right for you. But if you know that there's an inner world, an inner life, that can be cultivated and developed, and develop a sense of well-being, ease, and inner freedom, then the outer world, you don't become so dependent on the outer world being a certain way. And the more this inner world becomes a rich resource for a person, the less hooks do we have in the outer world, the less we're dependent on the outer world, the less we'll cling to it or feel like we need to have it to be a certain way. That's not a dismissal of the outer world or a rejection of it. It's just that it doesn't, you know, we're not caught by it anymore as much before. So part of what the opportunity is with practice like mindfulness is not just to be aware more mindfully of the world and the sensations and all that, but as we become more aware of all this, to notice, are we clinging to anything? Do we have agendas? Are we trying to do something? Are we closing down? Are we pulling back? What is our relationship to things? It can be as simple as, you know, I noticed at lunchtime today that the lunch line went the whole length of that big room down there. And so I don't know, maybe all of you are quite content and peaceful about just standing in line. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do but stand there, do standing meditation. But I know that I've stood sometimes in lines and could feel this, you know, the situation is not unpleasant, but somehow what's unpleasant is my mind's stories about what I need to do and get to and what it means to stand in line. And so then there's this unpleasantness that's connected to it, and that unpleasantness then triggers further reactions and responses and more impatience. But is that really the case? You know, a very interesting, for me, discovery was times when I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't sleep. And I was miserable. And then I started looking more carefully, what's going on when I can't sleep in the middle of the night? So first I checked out to see, was the situation in and of itself pleasant or unpleasant? Turned out it was quite pleasant, the direct experience. I mean, I was warm, I was in bed, I was comfortable. You know, I couldn't sleep because I felt rested, I wasn't sleepy, it was felt actually kind of nice to be that way. And I was safe, I'd eaten enough. It was, you know, in many conventional ways, it was really a great circumstance. So in the moment it was fine. So then I looked, well, where's the suffering that I'm having? And for me, all the suffering had to do with the next day. This means that I'm going to be tired, it's going to be a drag, it's going to be hard, it's going to be embarrassing, I'll go give a Dharma talk and I'll fall asleep in the middle of Dharma talk and, you know, that's going to be, you know, hard. And I had all this, my world, the fantasies were started, what tomorrow was going to be like were taking precedent. And that's where I got caught and where the suffering happened around this not sleeping in the middle of the night for me. I don't know how it is for other people. And so I learned then to be much more, you know, when I made that distinction, I learned to just lay there and enjoy the pleasure of just laying there. There's no problem in the moment. The problems are all a fantasy about the future. And so for me, I was able to then put aside the future and just stay there. And then it's a nice trick too, because if you're not anxious, it's easier to fall back to sleep. So to look at what is our relationship, where are we reacting to? Where is the unpleasantness and pleasantness that we're responding to? Is it having to do with what's here and now? Or does it have to do with our projected ideas? Our fantasy, our imagination tells us it's unpleasant. Our imagination tells us it's pleasant. One of the reasons I've been sometimes caught in fantasy when I've been on a retreat, mind goes off in all kinds of fantasies and thoughts, is that for me, because sometimes they can be very pleasant to have them. And the hook is the pleasantness of them. And so I had to learn to recognize, oh, these things, it doesn't work just to try to let go of them. What works is to really identify how they're pleasant and then see the pleasantness and see how I get caught by that or lean into it or try to get soothed by it or something. And then I find my freedom from it, is to recognize a simple pleasant and unpleasant. And then as you begin to let go and as you start getting settled and more present here, is there something in the inner world, if you use that kind of language, that begins to peek itself up, begins to poke its head up? Something that I like to think of as being very shy, and you have to be very quiet for it to want to come out. But you know, there's a feeling of, you know, so what are these inner feelings, the not of the flesh kind of feelings that can begin coming up? Peace, some kind of well-being, some kind of feeling of safety, feeling of ease, feeling of rightness, feeling of being at home here. You know, different people have different languages for how they describe this. And it doesn't have to be dramatic. One of my little hindrances, a period of my practice, was assuming that I would only do the practice right if I had a dramatic experience. So I was always looking for something dramatic to know that I was, you know, on track. And nothing has to be dramatic. Nothing has to be anyway. Nothing has to be anything. We can just be there with as it is. And the simplicity of just being there with things as they are can produce this kind of deep satisfaction. There's a kind of, I like to think of it as part of the pleasure of this inner world, pleasure of the spiritual world, the pleasure that comes from being in touch with what's real. And I've certainly had my share of times of being in touch with what's not real, fantasies and projections and interpretations and commentary about things, about people and all kinds of things. One of the things I've learned is if I'm in conflict with someone, how important it is to actually be in the room with them, to be physically with them, because of my mind's ability to live in fantasies and projections and ideas of who they are. And that once I'm in the room, a lot of them fall away, and it's a whole different conversation that's possible than the conversation I'm having in my head with the imaginary person in conflict with. So the satisfaction of being in touch with what's real. And here we are. Mindfulness practice is a practice of being present here and now with what's real. And this is the only place you'll discover what's real, is here. If it's not here, it's not real. So to know and be in touch with your feet as you touch the ground and feel that contact. To be feeling the door and the door handle when you touch it, that's real. It's interesting to pay attention to how are you when you open and close doors, or say it differently, where are you? Are you somewhere else? Are you ahead of yourself? Doors are just to get through to the real place, the other side. But what is it to be with the realness of the door and just take the time to really be there and feel that realness? It might seem petty, the realness of the door, but it's the training ourselves to begin tuning in to the what's real here. And not just real doors and floors and the contact, but then as we get more present for the simplicity of just here, then we also start touching into what's real for us. And this inner world starts becoming realer and realer as well. And the greatest pleasure of the inner world is the pleasure of release, of letting go, of the clinging, letting go of the grasping, opening up the fist of the heart so the heart can blossom, can be open. So to kind of maybe a little bit summarize the talk, when we grasp and cling chronically, we limit ourselves. We limit our capacity to respond and experience and be. And that one of the ways of helping us to release the grasping and clinging, the resistance that we have, is to begin paying attention to the foundation levels, the basic levels of our experience. And the body and the feeling tones are part of that. And the feeling tones in particular are very useful to notice because of how often we react to those or respond to those, or that there's clinging and non-clinging, pushing and pulling and being for and against that happens in relationship to it. And so it's a very useful place to look and see. And in seeing that, perhaps there's opportunity to start becoming simpler with our experience. It's possible to see how we cling, how we react, how we grasp. And it's a very important part of this training is to be very simple and easy, respectful of our grasping and clinging. It's not a sin to grasp. You're not a bad person because you cling. It's just something else to notice, something to pay attention to get to know better respectfully. And as you do that, discovering the times when you can let go of it, or notice it when it releases itself. And then to appreciate what it's like when you're no longer grasping? What it's like when you're no longer tense? What it's like when you're no longer caught up? If you have moments of that, what's it like? Because in that what's it like, you might discover something of the inner life, the non-sensual satisfactions that we can have in our life. And when you feel these non-sensual satisfactions, a certain level of peace or ease or feeling of safety or joy, feeling at home, then it's very helpful to nourish yourself on that. Feel it, be with it, and let it kind of register deeply in you. In a sense, be nourished by it. The Buddha talked about drinking it. So drink it in, so that it can condition us, it can recondition us, it can undo some of the conditioning that has us all tight and tense. We can recondition ourselves by letting us drink in or appreciate or take time to savor the times when we do feel some sense of inner well-being. So if that should happen here, please enjoy it. Okay, so maybe we take a minute or so to regather ourselves.